Well, it's a pleasure to introduce our speaker today, who has done double duty as usual, just gave a very energetic and wonderful lecture on performative aspects of solidarity and other things in the Polish culture of dissent and beyond, really. I'm told that this is a continuation lecture, so that's a wonderful thing for us to have. Professor Elżbieta Matinia is at the New School for Social Research in New York. She's a professor of sociology and liberal studies and also the director of the Trans-Regional Center for Democratic Studies. And I think she's going to be talking to us about what that center is.
No.
Well, I don't know.
But you will figure out what it
okay.
is.
Okay. Absolutely fascinating. She studies politics and art from a sociological perspective. And also democratic transformations, and not only in East Central Europe, but also in other parts of the world, South Africa in particular. She has visited many times and is currently writing a book about that topic. Her most recent books are Performative Democracy in 2009, and if you haven't checked out Performative Democracy, it was a lovely book, a wonderful book. I read it rather late in the game, 4 years after it came out. And I believe it's been translated into a number of languages and has sort of taken off in the last several years, and it should, because it's a terrific book. And she's also the author, or really editor as well, of a book called An Uncanny Era, published by Yale University Press in 2014, which presents post-revolutionary conversations between two very well-known dissidents in East Central Europe, Václav Havel on the Czechoslovak side and Adam Michnik on the Polish side. So I will give the floor to Professor Matinia.
This is like Mike. I'm only hoping that I'm, that I will be fine, because some of my energy unfortunately went through the roof, but here I am. I wanted to also to say that when I was working on that piece, and I kind of knew I had to judge my time, it was in late November, early December. Things looked differently in Europe and in that part of the world that we are here to discuss. Also, things look differently in the United States. And what I'm and so, if, in case you have questions concerning things that developed since then, I would be happy to answer afterwards. And I think I will make various. I will allude to it a few times. So it was a little bit over 20 years ago that when the works of Omi Baba introduced to the larger public the concept and the cultural form of hybridity. Today, thinking in terms of hybridity is nothing peculiar, and in the world that we live in, the reality of hybridity will soon be more rule than the exception. As I stand here, I'm such a hybrid. And a lot of what I am about to say is anchored in that experience. I'm from the country that was once occupied by fanatics who were driven by the messianic fantasy of a purified world, a country that, for the much of the world, is known as the place where the plan for purity was meticulously carried on in the death camps of Auschwitz, Treblinka, and Majdanek. So I came from one of those bloodlines, as Timothy Snyder would put it. But now, though it still seems strange, even to me, I live most of my life in New York City, a place of diversity, plurality, populated by the arrivals from all around the world. And I come from a university, and more precisely from a particular division of it, that was established as the university in exile, established as a rebuke to the very politics and culture of Nazi Germany that would launch World War II and facilitate the eventual design and enactment of the final solution. The university in exile, which in 1933 welcomed German Jewish refugee scholars to the new school, was founded on principles diametric opposed to Hitler's, as the core, at its core, was a respect for reason, for pluralism, for rigorous self-criticism, democratic ambiguities, and negotiable differences. while armed forces could defeat Germany's war-making machine, Nazism, with its rigid certainties, had to be confronted by ideas and eventually by the International Tribunal in Nuremberg. One of the things I remember best, most vividly perhaps, from my early childhood in Poland, not that I was there only when I was young, it's just I remember from childhood, I left already quite a grown-up person who came to this country to learn English. So one of the things that I remember vividly, and something that comes back to me again and again, is a radio program that began with the following announcement, and I think it was daily program. This is a Red Cross box in search of lost families. Tu skrzynka poszukiwań rodzin Czerwonego Krzyża, in case you can follow. That program must have been broadcasted daily, as I said, and I still hear the voice of the announcer. And a long and for a child tedious a list of names. I remember seeing in my mind a large wooden box painted over with a red cross painted over it, which I imagined being opened loudly at the beginning of every program and then being closed forcefully when the litany of names read on a given day was over. There had to be hundreds of thousands of names read over the years. There was a rhythm associated with the reading and a kind of unfamiliar melody having to do with the way the unique names and places sounded to me. And there was one word in particular that I remember hearing, a difficult word for me to pronounce then, and one that I came to understand only much, much later. The word was repatrianci. Repatriates, repatriating people. And then one day the box was no more. The reading stopped. It had to be have been much later than this voracious young radio listener asked her mom, "What happened to that skrzynka, that box, mom?" "Well," said my mother, "it is so many years after the war, perhaps all the missing family members have been found." The dispersal and disappearance of people during protracted wars, whether as a result of forced removal or flight from danger, is always tied to the hope that those one has heard, that one hasn't heard from, may still be alive, that there might be someone who spotted them somewhere, that they escaped through the barbed wire, that they were picked up from the sea. And the reason we don't hear from them must be that they cannot write, that their cell phones cannot be recharged, or their phone card is empty. And this hope is deeply invested in the existence of solidarity. We hope that those close to us have been rescued by somebody out there. And they, of course, also hoped that they would be rescued by someone. In 1931, years before Hitler came to power, and 8 years before the war broke out, Walter Benjamin, perhaps one of the most perceptive, brilliant cultural critics of the time, wrote a letter to his friend Gershom Scholem, and I'd like us to try to see the image behind these words from his letter. "Like one who keeps afloat on a shipwreck by climbing to the top of the mast that is already crumbling. But from there, he has a chance to give a signal leading to his rescue." Do we see this? Do we hear the optimism in Benjamin's words and the confidence in the signal that would bring about the rescue? With this, do those signals matter today? Who gets them? Who sees these signals? With this hope grafted onto tragedy, does she or he have a chance? Did Benjamin have a chance when 9 years later, in 1940, as a refugee from the Third Reich and then from Vichy France, he tried to cross the French-Spanish border to get to the ship in Portugal that was to take him to America? We know that on that very day, when he, along with others, arrived at the border, Spain closed it, and that during that night, Benjamin, exhausted and ill, took his own life. I wonder about the loneliness of Benjamin and now the painful loneliness and humiliation of today's refugees fleeing the danger on their own respective bloodlands, in their own respective bloodlands. Hannah Arendt spoke about the loneliness of those living under totalitarianism, about the anxiety arising from loneliness and alienation from the world. Many generations of Poles throughout the 19th and 20th century have been very familiar with that condition, and they still are. Arendt herself, a refugee who escaped from Germany to France and then flee France to America, knew perfectly well that to be a refugee from an oppressive nation state or from a war, and to find oneself in a condition of involuntary diaspora, which is a combination of statelessness and rightlessness, dramatically heightens that sense of loneliness. To find oneself in such a situation is something nobody would want. We ourselves, now, I mean we, Poles, know very well that condition, that nurture and sustain an authoritarian authoritarian context that in turn renders people inconsequential and their lives apparently worthless. Yet today, an openness to receive the signal and the impulse to organize a rescue mission hardly enjoy unanimous support. As the refugee arrived on the shores of Europe, I worry that we can hardly share Benjamin's optimism, 1931. It seemed that today we live in precarious times resembling rather Kristallnacht, and one asks oneself the question, how can this be happening? I will always remember the moment on July 22nd, 1980, when Edward Gierek, first secretary of the Communist Party and the ultimate leader of Poland, delivered his obligatory address on the anniversary and establishment of the Polish People's Republic, the National Day of Rebirth. In this anniversary speech, it was 35th anniversary, and each year he had to say what kind of achievements, what did we achieve, what wonderful had happened. And so in that very anniversary speech, which was 35th, that was to praise the achievements as defined by the Communist Party state, when it came to proclaim the recent accomplishments, regime's accomplishment, the only success our leader could come up with at a time of political, moral, and economic crisis was that socialist Poland was now ethnically pure, at last, a country without minorities, inhabited happily only by real Poles. Purity was the prize delivered by the communist regime. His glorification of a communist state as a bounded biopolitical space, dangerously echoing the Nazi ideal, went somehow unnoticed then, as just 2 weeks later, the watershed August strikes in the Gdańsk shipyards and the emergence of Solidarity Movement launched a long-running rights revolution, first in Poland and then throughout the region. At the core of this struggle was the right to open and maintain an initially defiant public square, in which people could meet each other, a theater of public life where loneliness would be broken, where speaking in public on things shared in common could take place, where a sense of both equality and dignity would be palpable. The symbolic setting under the national flag was to offer protection and emphasize the unity of the people against an autocratic regime. Nobody worried then that such a setting might eventually provide nourishment for the biopolitical exclusion of an alien or foreigner, or for the questioning of any other kind of other, whenever politically advantageous, as with today's refugees. Despite the monumental changes that have taken place in Poland as a result of the negotiated revolution that began as an act of solidarity with the shipyard workers, it seems as though some things have not changed, and more recently, some changes may be undergoing a reversal. And this is not just about Poland. All right, it is true that in the world we live in, a person has to be territorially anchored, to have a home and to have rights. And now the Poles, by virtue of having a double anchor, A, in their still young democratic nation state, and B, in the European Union with its institutions and protections, so Poles actually have rights. a whole family of rights having to do with political citizenship. Let's put in parentheses the constitutional crisis that's taking place right now in Poland. Maybe we can talk about it later. Yet solidarity with the dispossessed, something that ought to have a familiar ring, and a recognition of the universal human rights of refugees and forced migrants, seemed largely absent, or at best controversial. So the question is, how come? I wonder what Arendt, Hannah Arendt, with her passionate gift for engaged reflection about our times, and a thinker I consider my guide and illuminating spirit, would say about all of this. How would she help me, us, if she were still with us today? As she was a professor at the university I come from, I have listened to her students and colleagues and learned that with all her mastery of theoretical distinctions, she steered students away from theories and instead made them read and appreciate memoirs, plays, poetry, tales, stories, and images. What I call here, maybe I should say something else. What I call here a theater of politics needs a public square. Hannah Arendt would say, we need a public space in order to function as individual human beings. We need a public space. The theater of politics needs agora, a space where one can hear others speak and where one can enter into deliberations. Rereading Arendt's Human Condition today, obviously making some allowances, as it was published almost 7 decades ago, one could make the case that in generating the conditions for both plurality and hospitality, theater of public life, theater of politics, ought to be seen as the ultimate incubators, as sustainer of public life. To be sure, I'm not thinking here about theater in terms of popular sociological metaphor handy for explaining the workings of a society. This is how the father of social interactionism, Irving Goffman, argued that in the theater of everyday life, people are cautious about the way they present themselves to others. No. For me, theater is not just a useful simile to observe things social and political. Theater is life, it's reality, and not an illusion brought on by the play of passions upon the imagination. Though not entirely free of emotion, it is above all a spoken word, a speech act, and a dialogue that allow a meaningful encounter and a conversation to take place. Conversation, like attendance at the theater performance, is almost always voluntary, not necessary. First, we have to agree to talk, to listen to each other, to listen to each other's stories, and through this to get to know each other. In the real theater of public life means the expressive life of a polity, a process in which the private individuals act on behalf of the public good. And in this sense, theater here represents humanity writ large. What a responsibility, one might exclaim. And to avoid misunderstanding, I'd like to add that the public theater I'm talking about is not limited to a nation. In other words, it's not ethnos, nor to a nation state, even though the latter is indeed a powerful social imaginary, as it is characterized by the combination of the private and public, which, as Arendt would have said, is concerned with kind of collective housekeeping. For the same reason, the theater of public life is nothing natural. It's not a super family. In any case, it's not an extension of the family, nor a collection of groups or groupings. There is nothing organic about it. Rather, there's something man-made, an artifact, a socially constructed, fabricated site, indeed a crucible, an infrastructure that supports critical relationship between persons and public. And for me, in a time that I call democratic Lent, not democratic carnival, but democratic Lent, and multiple crises, the time of multiple crises in various parts of the world, it is a site of hope. Again, the theater I have in mind is constituted by two key elements, a publicly spoken word and a public space, where this word could appear, the Arendtian space of appearance, in which those who come together consider each other equals. Along with the rules of conduct, this vaguely corresponds to the Saussure, la langue, if you are literary, scholars, and infrastructure, a set of arrangements that makes encounters, exchanges, discussions, and conversations possible. An infrastructure for hope. The opposite of orchestrated public rallies or spaces that encourage the kind of conspiratorial group arts, acts that can lead to a thermidor or genocide. Every act speech takes place in the theater of public life. Taking place in the theater of public life is an act in between, and that in-betweenness is ultimately an act of sharing, which while relating individuals to each other, also allows one to continue being a distinct actor, that is, a separate, discrete author of unique speech act entering into dialogue with the other. Without the theater of public life, without its man-made infrastructure, democracy cannot be experienced, cannot be really experienced. And in saying that, I'm completely aware how vulnerable to a positivist critic my argument is and how naive it may sound to some. Nevertheless, I strongly believe that, as with the procedural dimensions of democracy, the socio-infrastructural dimension of the theater of public life is of key importance to all of us. It provides an enabling setting, both for the dissolving of loneliness and for an unleashing of the democratic imagination, and thus also for a relishing of civic life. It is a domain where words are actually listened to and exchanged, a domain of disclosures shared between individuals, of meaningful insights, negotiated differences, and newly gained knowledge, or perhaps better, a dynamically imparted knowledge, something that cannot be acquired just by reading books, but is absorbed by our being in dialogue with the other whom we do not yet actually know. Arendt, in her last interview she ever gave, brought up the issue of happiness. When individuals take part in public life, she said, they open up themselves a dimension of human experience that otherwise remains close to them, and that in some way constitutes a part of complete happiness. Indeed, I would add, action-oriented speech arises from real plurality and not from the bipolar concept of the world of politics based on the Schmittian logic of friend versus enemy binary. Although in a performative creation of the world, a clear-cut friend-enemy distinction is hard to sustain. Nothing here is predetermined. The theater of public life is actually an agonistic place, a crucible for tensions and disagreements. The exchanges do not come easily. Life in the public square does not presume consensus. Quite to the contrary, it's a site of agon. Dialogue in the public square is often contentious, and though it is not driven by conflict, at its heart is, more frequently than not, a dissensus rather than a consensus, as Rancière would argue. I would say, as somebody who long ago caught the virus of hope spread by Poland's father Tischner, that although critical passion does not always come with passion for understanding, a dialogically articulated dissensus opens up the potential for understanding and for establishing a measure of trust, even if it means not embracing the position of the other. However, this inclusive, open-ended space is neither friends nor enemies, though not without antagonists and opponents, has the capacity to incorporate strangers, including, as I am trying, among other things, to suggest, migrants and refugees, whether from nearby or afar. For it is here, in this theater of public life, that individuals can have an opportunity to recognize the independence and to acquire solidarity, not just passive empathy, but an active solidarity, and to work together to create a shared world. Of course, the theater of public of dialogue in public life has not only a procedural Lalang dimension, but also a substantive one, because it is also a parole, an event. As inclusive as the theater of public life is, its performances are hardly universal. Being both inclusive and accessible, this theater is a forum, or better, an agora, in which individual paroles face each other, exchanging their respective experiences, insights, and local knowledge. Again, what we are discussing here is a purposeful encounter of denizens, those who are living here and now. We saw it every night in the Zuccotti Park during the heyday of Occupy Wall Street, on Tahrir Square, and during the negotiations with the regime within the Gdańsk shipyard, vividly captured in the documentary film Workers 80. Alexis de Tocqueville, in his appreciation of that early infrastructure of American democracy, a New England town meeting, reports on an event dedicated to ways in which one could help the Poles, who in their November uprising of 1830, were challenging the rule of an oppressive Tsarist empire. Here is the voice of a clergyman speaking at that meeting. "Turn, Lord, a favored eye upon the other hemisphere. Pitifully look down upon that heroic nation, which is even now struggling, as we did in the former time, and for the same rights which we defend with our blood." What impressed the Frenchman, Tocqueville, was how the religious establishment in America cherished both democratic and republican institutions, and how, as he put it, clergy of all different sects hold the same language of democracy, their opinion being consonant with the laws. Do we see this kind of accord today? Do we hear such sentiments today? Or are we living in an increasingly and dramatically divided and divisive world? And does it not sound both appalling because of what we see, yet also uncannily familiar when we hear about the refugees from the distant war-torn places, victims from those worlds where the public square has been shut down? For the theater of public life to be a site of meaningful encounter is paramount, yet this is where the plurality is expressed, where diversity demonstrated, and this is where hospitality is tested. This is where we can try walking in the shoes of others. But somehow, today, not too many of us want to walk in somebody else's shoes. It seems as though we, recent members of European Union, we Poles, have worn such a shoes already, and we are happy to discard them along with that wooden box with the Red Cross painted over it. And no matter how worldly, universal, and indefinite this theater appears to be, it is always place-based. And even if this world word-oriented, it is always a site of specific local encounters, reverberating with issues that are pertinent to those who live there. Needless to say, the theater of public life is more like regular theaters. It's not a heaven. It does not have one location. But it also is not given. It might be barely attended. People may took it. May think that since the infrastructure is there, it would be like a faucet. We turn the knob and the water flows. There are pipes. And the democracy will be there whenever we want. The point is that we need this water to flow continuously, or the theater of public life, the precious human invention, would dry out. We have to defend the public square. Though it cannot directly solve the problems, the inequality or social injustice, the theater of public life cannot be abandoned. And indeed, for the theater of public life to exist, the right to enter and perform in public has to be not only ensured, but also constantly exercised. Without its parole dimension, this event dimension, emptied of concrete actors and individual voices, it could turn into Potemkin Village, set up to mislead both the locals and distant international public opinion. And it often does. But the public square cannot solve our problems. When it works at its best, the theater of public life, this potent social construct, provides, along with its creative, action-oriented, performative capacities, a priceless epistemic terrain for generating new ways of seeing and knowing the world, and subsequently shaping or reshaping society's practices. When eradicated, when closed, or when turned into a Potemkin village, it silences the voices and prevents, curbs, or brings to a standstill what I call performative, democratic performativity. Such silencing arrangements are closely linked to a regimented shrinking of the public realm in general, intervening and in and limiting our comprehension of the world, and leading to violent conflicts, as I shall explain. Yet the knowing that I'm talking about, the knowing that it's a condition for action, is not a solitary experience. It urgently does need others, as it relies on a dialogue with them. And thus, it needs the public square. The knowing generated there cannot be, and never is, absolute or predetermined, as it is locally produced. And in the course of encounters with the other, continuously open to adjustments, amendments, and corrections. The quest for knowing drives away ignorance. And I think Arendt, with her inclination to explore thinking, would have seen its entering appeal. Cognitive value of popular understanding that is a preliminary understanding expressed in everyday language and that thrives in theater. When the chips are down, as Arendt would have said, it is public square that provides the vital sense of reality and serves as society touchstone. Otherwise, we believe we know, but we do not. Without a public square, our actions might be based on what I call misknowing. In other words, I'm arguing that it is not just in order to think and act, but also in order to enter in the process of knowing, including an awareness of one's own limited knowledge, that one needs that kind of richly functioning public realm. It opens up for us the possibility for the interplay and of intersubjectivity and sociality. Several months ago, in late September, a mural freshly painted on the wall of a Brooklyn apartment building had become a site of major controversy in the neighborhood. I don't know whether you heard about that. And had been vandalized in the neighborhood and had been vandalized with white paint splattered over it. About 8 meters tall, so very tall, painted in different shades of gray, it represented the vertical half of a woman's face in a headscarf, with a tear in her eye and without lips. When I saw the picture first in the New York Times, the mural reminded me, though it was much more realistic, of the Bread and Puppet Theater's Gray Lady Cantata, which I had seen many, many years ago. Some in the neighborhood in Brooklyn were outraged by the image, as they saw it as an expression of anti-Americanism that in post 9/11 represented disrespect for the victims of the terror attack. In fact, the mural painted by a South African artist was an act of international solidarity to protest human rights violation in Iran. More specifically, it was painted in support of an Iranian woman artist, the illustrator, Athena Farghadani, who had been sentenced to 12 years in prison for depicting certain Iranian politicians as animals. To be sure, there was also many defenders of the murals, described by the New York Times as slightly younger and newer arrivals to the neighborhoods, who said they thought the criticism was motivated by xenophobia. When word spread that the owner of the building was planning to remove the mural, several neighbors urged her writing in emails that it would be wrong to allow a protest over the silencing of an artist in Iran to be silenced in Brooklyn. Indeed, the automatic insertion of the unknown into what appears to be known does not work. Moreover, it may be divisive and disturbing. In Iran, the square where exchanges could take place had been deactivated for many decades, or like the lips of the woman in the mural was missing. In Brooklyn, there were infrastructures available for arranging such an encounter, but they were not used. A neighborhood discussion in advance about the proposed mural had not been undertaken. To use yet another language, the condition for successful performativity were not in place, and the mural became an example of unhappy performative. And now it is Arendt's fundamental investment in the social and political aspect of thinking, that is, being able to think from the point of view of the other, that brings us back to the public square and makes it possible to connect thinking, understanding, and knowing with acting. The close association between of language and knowing, and on the other hand, the realization of the presence or absence of acts of disclosure through speech and action in the Arendtian theater of politics, may actually help us to track down the grounds of misknowing. This is why public square is so crucial for us. The reality experience there, and together with others, makes it possible to examine the perilous problem of misknowing in relation to other distinctions crafted by Arendt. The public square, even if not the primary site for generating knowing, is a site of dialogue where a citizenry of inquiry, if I may put it this way, can find home. It is a stage where competitive discourses can be presented, confronted, and examined. It is where the people experience each other, and with the company, and in the company of others, become aware of the limited nature of their own knowing, and therefore their own ignorance, superstition, or prejudice. And it's precisely for that reason that this is a place where trust can take root. Along with Arendt, I would like to think that this is a site of freedom, and that she would call, of what she called worldliness, and let's us emphasize here, a locally generated worldliness. My attitude here is not quixotic, and I do not think that if people got to know each other, the world would immediately be a better place. But there is something to be said for trying to get to know other people and perhaps even trying to walk in somebody else's shoes. I believe that the key here is the very act of initiating the conversation about each other's worlds, a path leading to recognition of the merits of other lives, culture, and people residing among us. It is the theater that otherness can be has been explored best. It is in the theater that otherness has been explored best, beginning with the Persians, Trojan women, Forefathers' Eve, the dead class, Apocalypse Configuris, Havel's audience, or closer to home, Angels in America. And it is also in the theater of public life that Poles met for the first time, and on the large scale, people they thought were Russians, who very early in 1990 became street vendors in various places in Poland, since there was shortage of everything, peddling also everything from new or old tools, scissors and irons to caviar. It did not take long for Poles to learn that those Russians were often Ukrainians or Belarusians. This is when they invited them into their homes. That's how they learned. This is when they learned about their lives behind the Soviet border. And yes, it is writers who reveal the virtues of storytelling and dialogue, arranging for us circumstances for engaged conversation, where norms of reciprocity and trust are enacted beyond blood relations and family. But literature, though potentially inspiring and the first step towards reducing mutual ignorance, it's not a replacement for actual personal engagement and get-together facilitated by the functioning public square. The power of exchange stories is they set in motion a gradual abstraction for personal desires, aims, lenses, and filters leads to thinking together about the issues we have in common. Indeed, we shall not be able to coexist in our respective cultures if our respective cultures cannot comprehend, to some extent, each other's idioms, histories, and terms. This point was eloquently expressed by Poland's late legendary national icon, Władysław Bartoszewski, at the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising 72nd anniversary observances last April, 5 days before his death at 93. He had experienced both Auschwitz and the Warsaw Uprising, was named a righteous among the nations for his underground work saving Jews, was a young journalist imprisoned by the communists for 10 years. Then he joined Solidarity and was jailed again. And then as a Poland foreign minister helped forge reconciliation with Germany. What he said last April was, we need to keep our dignity and values, such as tolerance, friendship, and the ability to make sacrifices across ethnic and religious boundaries. We can dream that one day this will become the norm for our children, because future generations of Jews, future generations of Christians, and future generations of Muslims, hopefully not extremists, will have to live together in this planet, whether they want it today or not. Bartoszewski was a tough-minded idealist who acknowledged the potential snag in such a dreams. But I have no doubt that in condemning the research attacks in Paris, he would have condemned, with equal vigor, the recourse to vengeful violence, and above all, the exploitation of politicians in both Europe and America of a mindless fear of the other. A discourseless space, it's not a public space, has not an epistemic space, and it nurtures neither the knowledgeable citizenry nor democracy. Indeed, knowing, or at least has the potential of being skeptical and therefore dialogical, as in Socrates' emblematic, "I do know that I don't that I know nothing," whereas misknowing is always monological, "I know that I know." But what happens to the life outside of dialogue when the life in certainty and monologue begins to appear more attractive, more desirable, or even convenient? What I worry about is that the distance between the public square, when it is silenced, and the square of violence, it's not really so big. The eradication of the public square is the eradication of democratic politics, enabling misknowing and ultimately making room for violence. And this is the situation we are witnessing today in various parts of the world. Hannah Arendt's well-known argument in her Origins of Totalitarianism makes a direct link between the destruction of public realm and the life and the survival of all tyrannies. And though not directly, it analyzes the ideas, policies, practices, and modalities that remove voices, eliminate multi-voicedness, confiscate questions, prohibit discussions, and produce a strangely mute theater of public life. And what happens when the public square is not denied, not eradicated, not shut down? When it sits there, but it's neglected, forgotten, abandoned, and atrophied? When the theater of public life dries out, is not frequented, and the right to know is flaunted as the right not to know? When a life outside of dialogue, when a life in certainty and monologue appears more attractive, more convenient, or more secure? Or when the dialogue is outshouted? And what if these abandoned squares quietly morphed overnight into arsenals in which only weapons, not words, matter? What if the only square we end up with are those of violence on the squares? Where will we find refuge? What is that we don't see this, or that we don't want to see it? Thank you.
Time for questions.
Are there
questions for Professor
Matting? I hope there are no questions.
This is a public square.
As theoretical as it was very. I know, I'm not silencing you. It was. I'm sorry because I had to skip some stuff, and I just realized that it's. I maybe didn't make a good choice, but I wanted to say it was very personal. So. Go ahead.
So I want to ask you. You are at some points in the talk, I thought you were using public square in a metaphorical sense. Mm-hmm. In others, I thought you were referring to a more institutional concept of there are various institutionalized fora in which people come together. And, you refer to a protest, the Wall Street protest.
Or the New England town hall.
New England town hall, right. And so I guess I was asking, are you making an empirical argument that the institutionalized settings in which the type of exchange of views between people with widely different views occurs has actually, the frequency of the occurrence of those settings has diminished in our modern era? Or are you thinking more metaphorically, we've all gotten more closed into our own worlds where we're not having any dialogue with others as a result of a complex set of processes? So how much of it is...
I don't know.
Institutional, how much of it is metaphorical?
Yeah. I think it's actually both. So it started really with the metaphor. But one cannot... So it is, right, if you follow Arendt, it's just a metaphor. But she also talks about Agora. Agora is real. And for her, it was this ideal place for conversation, right? When the citizens, there was 10% of Athenians were actually able to be part of that, but yet they were. So I think that I'm making the same, this is a somewhat similar mechanism. If it's a problem, that is the same problem. I'm really more empirical, I think. I'm using that metaphor because I think sometimes it's easier to imagine things when we use metaphors. And I'm also a person who comes from the theater, so I have this background, so I tend to do that. But the reason that I'm saying, for me, I have data. I have data, look at those squares. I'm starting, I brought back, and I know that you might not know, but it was this one of the images was in front of the Gdańsk shipyard. That wasn't even done. That wasn't even a space kind of prepared for the meeting. This was a space to bring people in and out from work. This is where people gathered to actually assist in what was going inside, where the workers were negotiating with the government. And when there was this incredible fear that Russians may come this time, not by tanks, by ships, from the ocean. So this is where people came and they listened and they talked to each other. Some of those things were going through the loudspeaker. When they saw each other, and I think that's to see and to start. So we do need a real space. We actually do need space. And she talks, I'm so Arendtian that this is really sick, as I just realized when listening to myself. And she talks about so-called space of appearance. It's kind of very conceptual, but it's really a place when you can meet another person, and it's not in private. It's not at your aunt's birthday party, but it's because during the communist period, we actually hardly had such a spaces, right? When you went to the theater, but you could not, you listen, and that's it. So we use various private occasions for actual real conversations and larger conversations. And when we began to teach, right? When there were flying, I was a student, so I didn't teach. When there was a flying teacher, they went to private places, but there was many people. So there were 40 students sitting on the floor and discussing the issues which were not discussed in official and historical literature. So what I'm trying to say is, it has to be that place that one sees another. And can talk to another when the act is not a private act, but it's really a fact. So it has to be. So answering the question, it's empirical, but I like metaphors. Yeah.
So I think it's a very good idea. This idea of this public space, the way you describe it, it's certainly an ideal to strive for. But it it requires so much, right? And I feel like we tend to romanticize the past when we talk about it as something that we lost, and tend to kind of expect or hope too much from the future as a place where we'll kind of recover it. Well, to what extent has it ever existed? And like, what percentage of the people in the world have ever experienced it or something close to it? I mean, we kind of think of liberalism and of democracy as something which is kind of progressing and whatever, but whether we look at the past or the present, and this ideal that, it's not an ideal, obviously, it's something which is achievable.
Well, I lived through that.
I
have this problem, obviously.
So it's not just an ideal, it's something that we do experience. at least from time to time. But I don't know, I'm just kind of...
No, I know where you're coming. I mean, I know what you're talking about. This is one of my biggest difficulties, how to actually convey it so one can try from different, try to approach it from different ways to make it vivid. I do think that people experience it more and more. And it has to do with democracy and with, and you know, we should not underestimate that people want to live in democracy, even if they don't exactly know what it is. There is this dream, there is this idea, and then if you go and nowhere on there and not successful, if you go in the last 15 years, 10 years even, you know, through all those so-called colored revolutions, right? Orange Revolution, the Revolution of the Tulips, the Rose, Revolution of the Roses in Georgia, you know, all those kind of, and the Green Revolution in Iran, the Arab Spring, you know, if you think about it, there is this, on one hand, this incredible need to be together, and then often, not much, you know, sometimes it is, if the power is powerful enough, and powers usually are powerful enough, and they have the weapons, and the ideal of that kind of gatherings is to be peaceful and nonviolent, and actually in opposition to nonviolence. Very frequently, they collapse, and they collapse for all sorts of other reasons. You know, the whole. I was quite close with people who I was in Africa, in South Africa at the time, but. One sees the region differently, kind of the region, the continent. There is much more news, and then people were coming and going. And then I met one of the women leaders, journalists from Cairo, and I said, "But you know, it seems as though everything is going on." He said, "That doesn't matter, because this is that kind of experience that we had being there." On this square, which was a circle, and that our generation is not going to forget. And there is, and I think there is hunger. And you know, and I don't like watching that. I don't want to be misunderstood. I'm not talking about being a person, a part of kind of a mass and dissolving yourself in this, you know, incredibly homogeneous thing, which is just like me. It's just us, you know, translating. I into we, because it gives me a lot of power. No, that's fascism. I'm not going there. But there is a sense of actually individual, that individuals matter, and I think that they matter because they are recognized by another individual, and there is something that we all need. And liberalism is such a cold philosophy, theory. Yeah, it's of walls, right? It's, you know, here's private. Don't look. Yeah. And so it's cold. And when Arendt is talking about happiness, for me, the joyous kind of the experience, the joy of doing something together, building something together, you know, was the most formative part of my life, of living through that. So it's difficult actually really to talk about it. I also think that the walls, whether they're liberal or illiberal, more frequently illiberal, are also protecting us from functioning as those individuals, even though liberalism is such an individualist philosophy, right? But there is something about not being able to get that stuff which comes with being close to others, right? I'm not into this touchy-feely. I really don't want to misunderstand it. I'm always trying to say that this is all rational, but it doesn't have to be not joyous. It is joyous dimension of democracy, that kind of those moments of creation. They never last forever. I think we are in a difficult moment right now, even in this country, right? I call it Lent, you know? Carnival never lasts forever. It has its boundaries. But it allows us to test our possibilities of of actually functioning differently. Carnival is always the world, Bachman described it well, upside down, but to have agency and risk to act, to be able that you need, you matter, is also to act a little bit out of the box. And those moments allow us to avoid that creativity, which allows us, as some viewers would say, act otherwise. No?
So I'm very sympathetic both academically and idealistically, I don't know how to put it, to the idea of the public square. But I'm wondering whether, and this is sort of a thought maybe, or rather than a question, I'm not sure I can formulate it as a question, but I'm wondering whether thinking about public life as theater is role constraining, maybe? Because, and maybe this is, again, I'm thinking about theater very literally, but when I think about theater, there is performers and audience.
I skipped that part.
and there are scripts,
it was too much, yeah.
And there are scripts and
roles,
and sort of, when we think about public square as a stage, is it, who is it staged for? Is it for the actors? Is it for the viewers? Is there such a distinction there?
Yeah.
Should there be such, who writes the scripts? So this, I have all these questions. And
I think that they're very legitimate question, because I do use theater in a very loose way here. I just defended myself vis-a-vis Goffman, but I didn't do other things. I am explaining at some point that actually they are not spectators. Because when we are talking, even this momentary spectator is, it's a second later an actor. So in fact, we are all actors.
Oh,
the actorship, I'm calling that actorship. But you know, I also feel that sometimes to press too much, that simile might not be good, but on the other hand, I don't know any better. I don't know any better. The theater for me is a kind of an open-ended space, and it's rather a space of creativity than a space of reenactment. But I do believe that people, when they are given opportunity in that space, they enact democracy. And that's what they call performance democracy. Yeah.
Can we think about that as improv rather than theater?
It is much more. And in the book I'm writing about it, it's much more like, it's much more, you know, it's absolutely, this is like writing on the stage, if you wish, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Can I follow up to that, or briefly? There's a term in theater studies called spect actor.
Yeah,
right, so
nice.
It's both witnessing
that's
and
nice.
Participating, and when you have those walls, you know, they fall down. And the other follow-up to directly to theater, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to take the floor, but, you know, the course you just gave a lecture in, which is the Culture of Dissent course, Czechoslovakia and Poland, we read and talk about performativity, we read a lot of plays, Havel's plays, we read some Polish plays, and what one of the challenges of that, and it relates directly to what you're saying, and I want to get your response and maybe everyone to think about this, is that American students come with a certain preconception about what theater is. And it's a very consumerist, entertainment-oriented preconception, right? It's sort of what you were suggesting, you know.
I come from a communist background.
Okay.
So you know the opposition of theater.
It's not entertainment, but propaganda.
Which really are not too far apart in terms of how we relate to it, right? And you know, the American concept of theater, if they ever go to theater at all, is this kind of, as I say, it's like Cats on Broadway.
It's not off, but it's
And there are American theaters that do what Central Eastern European oppositional theaters do, which is provoke, don't solve questions, create an open space. They're kind of meta-performativity commentaries, right? This is trying to get you involved. And then, of course, we have this idea of theater of the oppressed in Brazil with Boal, which is kind of a theater as therapy and all of this stuff. So my question, and just generally, is, so what happens in a democracy in which, an existing democracy, I suppose we still have a democracy, nominally, in which the very conception of what it means to experience theater is reduced to this
level of entertainment and consumption rather than the spec acting, or the, however we're going to phrase that, right? Is that, I mean, it goes to the educational process, right? Are we going about this wrong? And is that an issue, really? Or should we need to bring back theater studies?
Yeah, that would be interesting to have people from theater. See, I came from theater, so I was this completely, and we were doing revolutionary theater. I mean, you could not do much, but students, when they got together, you know, nobody actually knew what we were doing. So we were able to do something in the basement of the department, and you know, and we were basically, we didn't use any, it was this kind of understanding that we are not using any stuff which was written, because it doesn't make sense that some professional theater do it, but we done our own stuff. We're all very much into Grotowski and all that stuff, you know, the minimum words. And I eventually used some of that experience, but bringing in that kind of, if you wish, improv, but it's that kind of an engagement with theater in 1970s and 80s, which I know from Poland, in the chapter which I called Staging Freedom. It was all about that. We kind of imagined how we could do, it was also creating a community between those who were spectators and actors, because actually spectators were sometimes actors. So I am indeed, and I don't have answers for you what happened. You know, it's entertainment. It's entertainment. It's commodity. It's commodity, and it's it has different functions, but it doesn't open up. Mm-hmm. Well, that's all. Oh, look, I went to see Disgrace. I don't know whether you guys know Disgrace. It's an amazing play, and it was on Broadway, and I could not believe it. I could not get myself out of there. No, and I'm very much here. I could not get myself out of the seat. And it's a complicated, brilliantly written thing about how difficult it is to get out of one's own identity if everybody wants to frame you in this identity, and it's just amazing. And it's about Muslims and Christians and Americans. I don't want to completely disregard it, but for me, it is really about having a discussion in public. And for that, you know, there was no such a theater ever in the world of that kind. But when the so-called Great Reform in the theater began in the beginning of 20th century, when the stages were actually erased, you know, and the theater all around, the people were sitting like we are sitting and playing here, and that kind of is of that kind of I'm thinking about. It's a difficult question. No idea how to answer.
But just to very briefly say, so you know, if what I realized when teaching this course was when I talk about performative democracy.
Yeah.
They don't really understand that. I can explain that to them, but they don't have the association with theater to begin with. So that's the real the difficult issue, right? And explaining it abstractly, you know, whatever, it doesn't really do much. Sorry.
That's okay. Thank you very much for opening this discussion. Actually, mine was also a follow-up.
No.
We had some kind of occupation movement in Turkey, in Istanbul,
I have students from Turkey. I'm very much with you, and we signed all the letters now.
And
did you sign the letters because people are fired from the job?
There was a post that time on social media saying that people turns to Batman at night, but in the morning they go to their work and have their suits, their ties. They are acting, actually. They were saying they were acting as rebellions or vigilantes at night in Turkey. Actually, I think the identification is really good. And my background is very similar to your background, not communist, but very leftist. I have a question about it. Your description of public sphere is different from the philosophers of critical thinking's, philosophers' definition who describe public sphere mostly.
Like Habermas, you were thinking about
Habermas and Althusser and Gramsci, they all describe it between state and citizen, but here, you are bringing some more confrontation between the people in the public sphere. What would be your definition for public sphere, your own definition?
So there are various ways to think about it. One of the first distinctions I would say, this is not a positive definition yet, but negative definition, but something that may actually reverberate with you. The public sphere, and or rather what's public and what's official, it's not the same. In a place that I made those distinctions almost everywhere. So I think that there are ways in which there is a pretension, or there is an effort to make people believe that's what official, what's officially designed for the public, it's public. Because it's controlled, by the institution, of the state. Whereas for me, the public is something that people control themselves. That it's so it's a space of free or relatively free, if one can say, with maintenance of a certain with having or maintaining or protecting certain conventions, because speech is a convention after all, and it is all about speech. But it is the sphere in which people can freely, and this is not so far from Habermas actually, and reasonably enter into a reasonable communication. But I do not want to mix everything which looks like public when there is the parade of one kind of another organized by the state or by the regime. I'm actually not talking about it. I'm talking about something completely opposite to that. So I'm talking about the self organization of society, self-organization of the conversation, self-emergence, generating knowledge on the basis of exchange by the free individuals and free actors. It is different than the. I'm not sure to what extent it is different as critical, because I think I'm somewhat with Habermas. It's just that for Habermas, it is a very specifically bourgeois. What he was interested in, and his classical explanation of that is the bourgeois public sphere. Whereas I'm trying to see that this is something in which people can enter, and if they're curious and willing, actually, to step in somebody else's shoes, as I said, or use somebody else's glasses or lenses, and see through them, and talk about how it is to see oneself from this other perspective, that then something is generated there, which is more than just communication. I don't think I gave you a good example. So it's also public for me, and from this point of view, it is part of the kind of liberal outlook, is distinguished from public, from private. Public sphere is a sphere of civil society. This is where, and that's why I'm saying, when citizens or people who want, aspire to be citizens, come together. And it's not a sphere of the state, right? If you are looking at the three traditional ones, that's basically they know thing, but it's not a sphere of the state, so it's not where the public officials work, supposed to work on behalf of public good. It is not a sphere, it is not a market or economy in which private units work on behalf of the private people. It is where private people work on behalf of public good. So that's that sphere that for me. So it's just kind of this particular dimension.
So how is it different from civil society?
This is not. I just described civil society. This is no. So what I'm trying to say, this is the dimension that I see as the. So in liberalism, right, if we would not have a civil society, we would have this terrible thing, public, private. Fortunately, there is this moment of a milder communication, I kind of can say steps, you know? So there is this place to work, which is civil society, right? So it's not, so it's, and this is how I understand. So it's not owned by the state, it's not owned by corporations, it's owned by people. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it is clear. what I described was absolutely society in a very rough way, described broadly and harshly and not very, not very subtly. Yeah.
But it also sounds like more, in a more Arendtian sense, you think that without that public space, politics is not possible at all. Because from Habermasian point of view, I think the sphere of the state is possible without the public sphere. And so here, this is where politics is being sort of created, seems.
Well, with our experience of totalitarian or autocratic states, or various dictatorship, in which, you know, even if there is a square, it's silence and it doesn't function, right? So from that point of view, I'm very cautious with the state. I'm even cautious with liberal democratic state. Look what happens in my own society, right, and my own country. And I just recently came 2 weeks ago from Poland. And it seemed as though that this is absolutely difficult to imagine. So the place which was the most quickly growing and economically most the biggest success, economic success in Europe in last 8 years. There was never a crisis in Poland after 2008. And it seemed that people were able to absorb, probably because of the prior experiences, and they were able to build on it. And the unemployment, which was very long, for very, very long time, went down half. The poverty level went down, again, another similarly 50%. The corruption, because of a fairly well-established legal system, was virtually kind of disappearing. People's lives were much better than before. In all that situation, people went and elected and decided to vote against the perhaps somewhat too neoliberal, but nevertheless solid democratic framework, which is now being reversed, including the constitution, the constitution being reversed by the ultra-right-wing government, which is interested and almost completely interested in rewriting the history after 1989. The revolution that happened was betrayal. The 1989 was a betrayal, and we will start the real. And you know, and those are things that people do much. I don't even know why I'm talking about it. There was in relationship. I guess I'm just tired.
No. One more question, maybe?
Please do. I mean, don't think about it. I just don't remember where I started. I started somewhere.
Well, maybe regard to what you just said, being kind of telling the story of Poland as not being in crisis, or at least not being in an economic crisis, or at least not a visible one. But I would argue that in all these European countries, there is an underlying crisis. Which is and you can capture it with the GDP or in unemployment or any of that. It's just this kind of the after effect of this huge dislocation, this amazingly deep social dislocation that transitioning from state-run authoritarian system to a market or whatever, state capitalism, whatever, or market, whatever you want to call it. But to this was something like a democracy.
I have to say that I disagree, and I was with you even half a year ago. I was absolutely, and I tell you why, because I began to think about it. You know, I did a lot of work. I tried to understand. Poland was absolutely in the worst economic conditions from all the places. You know, so the improvements are so startling that it's difficult to see that they are not. Moreover, Poland was most successful in youth. So even if you're right, and I was right half a year ago, that it is indeed the costs of transitions, which are, you know, people are dissatisfied because a lot of them ended up on the margins and so on. And I think this is true, and particularly when it comes to very old people or very young people, the precariat, so-called precariat, who work on the contracts and not on the full-time positions and so on. But even if this is true, that's very nice. I think somebody wants us to go. So even if this is true, I think in case of Poland, I just realized, and I go there often, and I say, you know what?
this cannot be everybody there, and I'm talking about simple people, and I go to the countryside. Their lives are, and they say themselves, they have two cars, they have a new thing, and it comes not from only from a very good economic kind of weather in Poland, so to speak, but also from a, so the cost of transitions were mitigated by enormous success, individual success of Poland, and I'm not sure how, in getting, in acquiring large grants from European Union. Poland won a lot of money. I mean, you know, this is out for grants, but you have to, well, you have to have administration which writes a successful grant, which reports and so on. Poland got so much money that, in fact, that economic costs that you are talking about, which probably apply in other places, are strangely, and which are they here too, are mitigated and are somewhat. So my question was, why did people, for example, countryside, I talked about farmers, which were always, you know, Poland always had private farmers were incredibly oppressed by the government because they had to produce for low prices. They could have their land, but they had to produce and give almost free their food, and that's why we never had food. And also because I'm not going to get into it. So those, the same farmers now, they themselves say that it's because they have organic agriculture, you know, farms. I have some family, and we went there, and we went through it was a weekend, and they were washing sheep in baby shampoo. Right? I said, "What are you? Oh, because there is a show, and our sheep are going to be great." They were there. I said, "You know what? But they have special money to produce the best, yeah, both wool and meat, and they specially fed." And you know, I said, "You know," and they are really affluent. I'm not saying that they have a lot of money, but you know. Okay. So what I'm trying to say is why those people, just to follow up what you said, went and voted for this ultra nationalistic, anti-European Union party.
But that might be an answer, because they don't want, like they didn't want the Soviet communism, now they don't want European...
That's what they say. That's what they say, because they repeat that. Yeah, this is exactly what they say. But so the issues are cultural and not economic, strangely.
It's kind of mixed. I mean, it's all kinds of things.
Okay, I'm with you. Okay, I just wanted to pay attention to something that actually Marx didn't, because why people, as I said, the class interest is somewhat, you know, we don't care, you know, it's our pride, it's you know, whatever, rational pride. So I think it's complicated indeed, and it will take time, and I hope that it's not going to break, that the Europe will not break, that the constitution is not going to be revoked in Poland as it was in Hungary, and it was changed. It was changed dramatically, right? So,
Well, thank you very much.
Yes, thank you very much.